From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last August 2016 at a Trump campaign rally in Wisconsin. Donald Trump made a direct appeal to African American voters. He argued that liberal policies had failed them. And he asked them, "What the hell do you have to lose by trying a little Trump?" Well, that, in a sense, is the problem for black conservatism, as described by the writer Chidike Okeem. Okeem argues that there is a natural, logical fit between African Americans and conservatism, but it is not as part of the mainstream American conservative movement today. Okeem writes that too often, mainstream conservatives in this country peddle anti-black rhetoric, support white supremacist ideas, and only elevate black voices who are willing to also peddle these ideas. But Okeem also writes that this should not mean there is no authentic, value solutions-oriented black conservatism. So how does he define black conservatism? And how can the conservative movement in this country broaden itself to be more genuinely inclusive? My guest for the hour is the writer and intellectual Chidike Okeem, who writes for many places, but you can find his home website, voiceofchid.com. And Chidike, it's great to have you on the program. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you very much for having me, Evan.
I want to start by telling you that I give a number of public presentations about sort of the state of the media, public discourse, and at a recent event, I was approached afterwards by a number of people who were self-identified progressives, liberals, and they said, "Look, you know, you tell us that it's important to read and consume and listen to voices of all backgrounds, but we get tired of the Sean Hannitys, etc. Are there more thoughtful conservatives out there?" And one of the first I put on the list is always Chidike Okeem. And I always take pleasure in making sure people understand that there's more than Sean Hannity out there and that that's not really, that's more of sort of a carnival kind of voice. But there's much more thoughtful voices out there. So I just wanted to put that out there at the start of the hour. So it's great to have you. And why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your background, you know, sort of where you grew up and how you came to this country.
Thank you very much. You're very kind. Well, basically, I was born in Nigeria, a region of Nigeria called Ibo Land, and I grew up in London, England, and I lived in California for 10 years before moving to Dallas, Texas.
Okay, and so you consider yourself, you're an American, also sort of, you think of your own British heritage. How do you describe yourself?
I would characterize myself as Igbo first, because that is my ethnicity. I think that makes up the bulk of who I am. Obviously, I'm British, and obviously, I'm American as well. So,
and I'm going to be, you know, sort of cribbing off of a wonderful interview you did with Intercollegiate Review this hour. I would encourage our listeners to check it out, and our producer Megan Mack and I will make sure on our Twitter feed it's there if you want to read it. I think it's very thoughtful, but I think it will give us a good jumping off point. And then listeners, as this program progresses, if you want to join the conversation, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Let me start with how I began the hour, Mr. Okeem, which is that, you know, Donald Trump himself took the opportunity to make an appeal to African Americans saying, you know, liberal policies have failed. Why not try Donald Trump? Why not try Republicans or conservatives today? And he kind of created this bifurcation that there was only two categories. You know, there's liberal opportunities, or there's liberal ideology for African Americans, and then there's the modern conservative movement. And I know you don't quite see it that way, but tell me your thoughts on when you hear people like Donald Trump saying it's either liberal policies or it's Trump.
Well, Donald Trump's rhetoric is actually quite amusing, because if you actually look at his policies, he cannot really be characterized as a conservative in any meaningful intellectual sense. There is obviously a lot of similarities between Donald Trump's policies and Bernie Sanders' policies. So characterizing Donald Trump as a conservative in any meaningful sense would be as preposterous as characterizing Bernie Sanders as a conservative. So I think Donald Trump's rhetoric conflates ethno-nationalism with conservatism, and ethno-nationalism can never be considered a legitimate conservative worldview.
You have been critical of some of the people that Donald Trump has elevated, people like Sheriff Clark. There are writers like Jason Riley, who has been on this program, talking about African-American writers talking about their views of modern conservatism. And one of the consistent refrains, at least from what I've read recently from you, is the concern that the conservative movement will elevate black voices if they are sort of properly critical of, you know, sort of African Americans more generally, if they sort of engage in the anti-black rhetoric that you perceive. Is that a fair way to describe your frustration with the way African American voices are elevated within the conservative movement?
Yes, absolutely. And even Clarence Thomas, Supreme Court Justice, actually said the same thing a few decades ago. He actually pointed out that cartoonish anti-blackness is how you rise as a black conservative in the media. So it's not something that I made up or anything like that. It's something that anybody who is honest and actually observing black conservatism in America has to kind of agree with.
And I mentioned Sheriff Clark, Jason Riley. Are there other examples, you know, just for our listeners to understand, you know, the specifics of this criticism?
Okay, so someone like Sheriff Clark, for example, he engages in the most hyperbolic, just cartoonish anti-blackness, such as criticizing Black Lives Matter as a terrorist group and just engaging in just outright trolling. And someone like Jason Riley engages in the kind of rhetoric that mainstream conservatives like, such as critiquing Chicago and saying that black-on-black crime in Chicago is a serious issue, which it is, but it's not something that you need to bring up as something that is emblematic of black life in America. And that's something that a lot of black conservatives who are in the mainstream actually do. And that's the kind of thing that actually gets you promoted within black, within mainstream conservatism, rather. So I think there are a lot of black conservative voices that are reasonable and that actually promote serious black conservatism, but the kind of black conservatism that we see in the mainstream that actually gets promoted is the kind of black conservatism that is just completely cartoonish and is used as a tool to actually promulgate white supremacist ideas.
All right, so let's talk about how you define then black conservatism. What's the broad description?
Okay, so I think black conservatism can be defined by limited government, personal responsibility, liberty, all of those ideas that you hear that are used to describe actual conservatism actually apply to black conservatism. However, I think authentic black conservatism also needs to be situated within the context of oppression and our reaction to oppression. While black progressivism says that white supremacy is permanent and omnipotent, I would even say. But black conservatives actually believe in the fact that humans have power to progress irrespective of different oppressive structures. So black conservatism is not about the preservation of oppressive structures. We believe that oppressive structures should be dismantled. However, even if there is no perfect racial harmony, we believe that black people can progress. And we also believe in the protection of constructs that have been salubrious to the black community in America, such as the nuclear family and the church and the community.
You told the Intercollegiate Review that it is Afro-pessimism that makes black progressives constantly downplay racial progress that has occurred in the United States. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so Afro-pessimism is this weird ideology that almost like deifies white supremacy. It's this ideology that kind of perpetuates the idea that white supremacy is both permanent and omnipotent. So it's something that a black conservative really cannot subscribe to. And Afro-pessimism is generally, I think, the driving force of black progressivism today. And it's something that if you read black progressive writings from Ta-Nehisi Coates to all of the celebrated black liberal writers today, that's the common dominant theme in their writings, that white supremacy is this all-knowing, all-powerful institution that is almost impossible to shake off or succeed despite of. So I think a black conservative cannot subscribe to that, and we actually reject that because we think that, yes, white supremacy is a problem, yes, it does need to be dismantled, but even if there is no perfect racial harmony, black people can succeed. And it is that optimism that black conservatives have, that black people have always had in America, and that is why there has been such progress. And if we start subscribing to ideologies like Afro-pessimism, I think it'll actually hamper black progress in this country.
Okay, and this is where I think there's an interesting kind of nuance to what our guest Chidike Okeem is describing when it comes to, in his words, Afro-pessimism. Because you also, while criticizing progressives in the African-American community for Afro-pessimism, you are also critical of the mainstream conservative movement for not grappling enough with its history and current embrace of white supremacy, right?
Yes, I am critical of them for that. And that's another thing, because mainstream conservatism and black progressivism are similar in ways that people don't necessarily notice. They are both characterized by a negative outlook towards black people, in the sense that mainstream conservatism is always about pointing out black crime, black pathology, black problems, and not so much about solutions. So that's why, in order to rise as a black conservative in mainstream conservatism, you have to be extremely negative about blackness. And that is a serious problem. But as for white supremacy within mainstream conservatism, it's something that is often looked at as a liberal lie against the right. And I think that that's a wrong way to look at things. There is obviously a link between mainstream conservatism and white supremacy. There are numerous examples of white nationalists at prominent conservative magazines and publications and think tanks. And if the right is actually serious about dealing with white supremacy, they need to come to terms with the fact that there are people in their midst who are white supremacists. And that's not slander. That is just a statement of truth.
Coming from a black conservative, you would think that they might be more willing to listen to it. And so who are the examples? You know, in your view, Chidike, when you look at the Trump administration, yes, some of the progressive opponents have said that this is an administration that has essentially embraced white supremacy, that and that white nationalism, which you have described as just sort of a shape-shifting term, alt-right white nationalism, it all sort of means the same thing. But is it a legitimate complaint right now that this administration is embracing white supremacy?
Oh, absolutely. There can be no question about it. Think about the fact that even, as we discussed, Sheriff Clark, he's one of the prominent black conservatives, and he is going into the Trump White House. The fact that Trump would even consider such a black conservative figure just shows that he does not, that he's trying to embrace white supremacy as an ideology. And it's also important to note that that black people can be faces and spokespeople for white supremacy. So somebody like Sheriff Clark, I would argue, is a spokesperson of white supremacy because he engages in that kind of rhetoric. And then we also know about all of the different people from Breitbart who were adopted into the Trump administration. Steve Bannon, for example, he has said completely white supremacist things. There's no way you can say that somebody in the Trump White House who actually, there's no way you can say somebody like Steve Bannon, who is a white supremacist, has said white supremacist things, isn't a white supremacist. And I think Trump is a white supremacist because he actually does promote all of these people, such as Steve Bannon and Sheriff Clark.
All right, let me grab our first phone call. It's Keith in Rochester. Go ahead, Keith.
I'd like you to define the modern terms of Democrat and Republican. I was born in the Mid-South Kentucky and just took for granted to say it that most whites were prejudiced. In the Civil War, you had the Democrats in the South, and today I guess they're the Republicans. And back then, the Republicans were the party of Mr. Lincoln. But my fellow conservatives today are trying to blame everything on the old Democrat Party. I'll give you a fast example. The Confederate General P.G.T. Bogart, whose statue's been removed in New Orleans, after the war, he spent his fortune getting Negro school children into Freeman schools, and the schools that did not allow Negroes were run by Democrats. So I'm trying to ascertain, discern here, that is, the old Democrats became the new Republicans, and I believe the first time that happened is when Eisenhower ran for president in 1952. Believe it or not, he got the rolls of his future white voters off the Klan membership rolls of five deep South Southern states, where I have relatives in Alabama. 1952 was the key year, along with Strom Thurmond, that, to say it, the old-time Democrats went Republican. And when FDR first came in office in 1932, that's when the old-time Abraham Lincoln radical Republicans became the party of the Democrats in the 1930s, and I'm just wondering if the guests can make heads or tails of how I grew up, admittedly a white guy in a conservative family in the South, and how basically, and this is my final comment, I want all my fellow conservatives to hear this, it really didn't matter whether you were Democrat or Republican, we were all prejudiced. If you were Caucasian, across the line, didn't matter the party, you were prejudiced and probably at least somewhat of a bigot. Maybe not a Klansman, but if you were white in the South as I grew up, yeah, we have to admit now we were all pretty much prejudiced if we were white.
All right, Keith, thank you for the phone call. Actually, Chidike Okeem, our guest, has written about this subject, about sort of this idea, or at least has commented in numerous places about the idea that, you know, sort of battling over which party has a more racist history and did it flip over time. So Chidike, go ahead. Why don't you take it wherever you want to take it there?
Absolutely. I actually agree with the tail end of what that call actually said, because I don't think it's helpful to say racism is part of the Republican Party only or part of the Democratic Party only. The way to understand racism in an intellectually coherent fashion is that it is an American phenomenon. The fact of the matter is, conservatives are racist, liberals have been racist too. And while I argue in my interview that liberals have largely solved their racism problem, their overt racism problem, I should say, as in you can't rise in liberal politics by being an overt bigot in the way that you can rise in right-wing politics by being an overt bigot, I don't think it is helpful to smear the historical record by pretending that just racism is either a liberal or conservative phenomenon. It is something that has been on both sides of the political aisle. With the liberal, on the liberal side, we usually hear the trope that the party switched places and then all good policies that were done by the Republican Party can be attributed to liberal ideology. But that is not necessarily the case, because we know that there are prominent liberal figures who were absolutely racist, such as Margaret Sanger, who was a racist eugenicist, and her plan for Planned Parenthood was the extermination of the black race. We know Woodrow Wilson, the president, he was a Democratic president, he was progressive, and he caused the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan by showing the film, the racist film, The Birth of the Nation, in 1915 while in the White House. We know LBJ, despite the fact that he did a lot for civil rights, we know he was a racist, and people don't pay attention to his racism because he is this big liberal figure. So while you can engage in this rhetorical prestidigitation of saying that the party switched places, you cannot really change the historical record, and it shows that both the Republicans and Democrats were racist, and we just need to start from there, I think.
Okeem, who is a writer and a public intellectual, and you can find his writing in many places, but his home website is voiceofchid.com. He writes a lot about black conservatism. He's a black conservative, but he's explaining why he thinks that term has often been sort of co-opted by the modern American conservative movement. And so on that note, Chidike, does the modern conservative movement, generally speaking, in this country, have to make significant changes before there's not sort of I guess what I'm asking is, can black conservatism exist within conservatism in a way that doesn't sort of run up against one another? And what has to happen before that can take place?
I don't think so. I absolutely do not think that black conservatism can have a place within mainstream conservatism, because whenever that occurs, it seems to be that black conservatives just end up repeating the rhetoric of mainstream conservatives. And also, we have to understand that there are certain incentives in mainstream conservatism that make black people repeat certain things in the way that they do. If you want to be on Fox News, you're not going to get on Fox News by telling the truth about Republican racism and white supremacy in the conservative movement. You are going to have to repeat rhetoric that is anti-black and that promotes a certain ideology. So unless there is some shift in incentives, I don't see how black conservatism can be meaningful and also be a part of mainstream conservatism. And I also don't think that black conservatives should be waiting for mainstream conservatism to change. I think we can actually advance ideas as an independent movement and influence mainstream conservatism from outside, maybe, but that shouldn't be the goal, being part of mainstream conservatism.
I've got a pile of listener questions. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back and we'll take your questions on a wide range of issues. Alan wants to know more about Chidike Okem's thoughts. He mentioned the nuclear family in Black America, so Alan's asking about that. We'll get that in. One of our listeners wants to know about his thoughts on Dr. Ben Carson's recent comments about poverty as sort of a mindset. Another listener wants to know more generally what our guest thoughts are on Black Lives Matter are, and we'll ask him to define what solutions-oriented Black conservatism means. That's a term you'll hear and read if you read more of Chidike Okem's writing. He's our guest for the hour, so let's get that break and come right back with your questions on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we continue our second round of interviews with the candidates for mayor of Rochester. We'll sit down with the retired school teacher, Lori Thomas. She'll talk about her activism, her work, the issues she thinks are most important in this race, including race, education, police-community relations, and more. Lori Thomas joins us next hour on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, talking about Black conservatism with the writer Chidike Okem. And listeners, if you want to join the program, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. This talk show has never been about the host or my view or whatever, but I have said that I think it's valuable to hear a wide range of perspectives and real intellectual perspectives, and I do think it's lamentable that voices like Chidike Okem, who I think if you read sort of far and wide, you'll see his work, but it's not on, you know, the nightly sort of cable news shows. It doesn't get elevated that way. It doesn't make all the money, and that is regrettable. But that's one of the reasons we wanted to invite Mr. Okem to this program today, to allow you to hear sort of a different kind of perspective on what Black conservatism means. And Chidike, one of the things that you write about is that it should be solutions oriented. Tell me more about how you define that.
Okay, so I usually try to shy away from defining solution-oriented Black conservatism by giving you policy positions, because unfortunately what tends to happen is people then think solution-oriented Black conservatism means agreement with me. And I do believe in debate, I believe in discussion, and I think there can be a range of different policy positions and perspectives among solution-oriented Black conservatism. So I try to define solution-oriented Black conservatism as a mindset. So while solution-oriented Black conservatism is about problem-solving, I would say frame-oriented Black conservatism, which is what I juxtapose it with, is more about problem-magnifying, and problem-magnifying towards a specific end. And that specific end is usually the titillation of mainstream white conservatives.
When it comes to the nuclear family, one of our listeners named Alan just emailed to say he'd like you to expand on your comments. He heard you mention the nuclear family earlier.
Yes, I believe in the importance of the nuclear family, and that is something that white, and especially the Black nuclear family, which has been destroyed. I would say that white supremacy has always been an enemy of the Black nuclear family, and it's something that is very fundamental to civilization. And when we start having children out of wedlock, and we start having family structures that do not respect the nuclear family, I think it's very problematic, and I think it causes a lot of problems, especially with crime and other social problems, I would say.
Is there a way to sort of put a dent in that problem, to start fixing it, in your view?
Yes, I think it begins with culture. I believe that cultural figures need to start promoting the importance of the nuclear family. I think cultural figures need to sort of come together and actually promote that kind of family structure, as opposed to the promotion of single-parent families and promotion of all of these other family structures that don't necessarily create a good society.
All right, so on the note of poverty, and we know that single-parent households are much more likely to end up in poverty, and Dr. Ben Carson, now the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in this country, recently said that he thought, and we talked about it yesterday on this program, Chidike, he said he thinks poverty is largely a mindset, that someone with a can-do attitude is going to find their way out of poverty, and someone with a can't-do attitude even with resources, is going to find their way back into poverty. And that was offensive to some of our anti-poverty workers who joined us on the program yesterday. I'm wondering how you feel about those comments and how you feel about Dr. Carson sort of generally speaking in his political views.
Dr. Ben Carson, I think I always cringe whenever I hear one of his public statements because you don't know what you're going to get from him. However, I do believe that his comments on poverty were taken completely out of context and the attacks on him were very unfair. He did not say that poverty is solely a mindset. That would be preposterous. What he said is part of poverty is a mindset. And I do believe that that is true. That, yes, if you want to grow economically, if you want to advance your economic status, you do need to have a wealth-building mindset. And you do need to know how to engage in a capitalistic society and be able to move in such a way that you will be able to increase your wealth. However, if your mindset is always on government and what the government can give you in terms of largesse, yes, you are going to stay in poverty. So you do need to have a wealth-building mindset in order to escape poverty. Had Ben Carson said that poverty is solely a mindset, I would be critiquing him along with all the other anti-poverty activists. But he said part of poverty is a mindset, and that explains why poor Chinese immigrants can come to America dirt poor, work hard, and send their children to some of the best colleges in America, and those kids go on to become doctors, physicians, pharmacists, and all of these impressive careers. Why? Because their parents had a mindset that was towards wealth building. Even if they couldn't attain wealth, they made sure that their children attained wealth. And I think attacking someone like Dr. Ben Carson, who grew up in poverty and actually became a respected neuroscientist or neurosurgeon, I think is very problematic. Somebody who actually escapes poverty, I think, is somebody we should listen to as an authority.
All right, let's move on to some other listener questions. Angela wants to know what you think about your thoughts on the Black Lives Matter movement more generally.
I support the Black Lives Matter movement up to a certain point. I think in some ways the Black Lives Matter movement needs a lot of direction. I think they need a lot of intellectual leadership. Currently, I don't think they do a very good job of actually framing the narrative. I think they allow too many slanderous comments about the movement to go unchallenged, such as the idea that the Black Lives Matter movement is a terrorist group. I think that's a preposterous statement. But there is no real intellectual leadership in the Black Lives Matter movement that can forcefully refute these claims. So I think it has potential, but as of right now, it needs a lot of leadership direction.
And Mark emails wants to know what your guest thinks about the successes and failures of Barack Obama as president.
As for President Obama, I would say he definitely should have done more for black people. That's for sure. There are other groups, Latinos, the LGBT group. He was much more vocal about their concerns. But where it relates to African-Americans, he tended to shy away from saying anything specific. And he would always come out with the trope that he's the president of all Americans as opposed to just black people. So I did think that that was kind of problematic. And I kind of wished he did more specifically for black people.
Do you... I want to ask you what you think about some of the common refrain I hear often from Democrats who will say, well, he had to be a little careful there. He did not want to come off as the angry black president, that black people in general are held to a different standard of emotion, that there is a caricature that happens to African-Americans in particular, often black women, but African-Americans in particular, that is unfair, and that the president was hyper aware of that. And so if he wasn't as aggressive on certain issues and in certain settings, it was because he was aware of the optics and he was sort of trying to play that game. Do you think there's something to that?
I could understand that as a point during his first term. However, during his second term, he's not running again. There was no political risk. So I could understand if that was the point that was made about his first term. After he got reelected, that's when he should have been freer to do a lot of things. But he didn't engage in the kind of activities that I would have expected for him to do in his second term. So
who do you find yourself voting for? Who do you find yourself supporting? Who do you find yourself rooting for if, as a black conservative, Chidi K, you have all kinds of issues with the progressive movement, in particular, you know, as you say, sort of this Afro-pessimism that can be, you know, sort of problematic, but you also have no real affection for the mainstream conservative movement for very strong reasons. So where do your allegiances end up lying?
I tend not to vote. I didn't vote in this past election. So I have absolutely no problem with staying away from the polls. I really do not mind not voting. I know some people find it like offensive when somebody says that they are not going to vote if they don't find a candidate that's appealing. But for me, politics isn't my entire life. I mean, if I don't see somebody who is worth my vote, I'm not going to vote. So I suppose Marco Rubio was somewhat impressive during the debate, but then he showed a lot of spinelessness. So I would say he was probably the closest person I would have voted for, but he ultimately didn't convince me to vote for him. So I absolutely do not mind staying away from voting.
Do you find yourself at all wishing that Donald Trump had not won this election? And then would that have changed your feeling?
I honestly didn't expect Donald Trump to win. I thought Hillary Clinton would. I believed all of the polls. But one thing I am very much certain about is that I'm not going to be completely crazy about every single thing that Donald Trump does. I find that a lot of people engage in hyperbole surrounding Donald Trump, and I'm not going to just let him just like control my entire brain for the next 4 years. So I follow the news, obviously. I don't like Donald Trump. I don't like his policies, but he's not going to like take up all of my attention for the next 4 years or for however long he's in the office.
A listener named Jane emails to ask a question about terminology and how black conservatives are sort of treated. And I'm gonna read her email. I'm gonna not use one term. I'm gonna use another. And I know it's offensive to some people, but I'm just gonna read this because I think it's a question I'm sure that our guest, the writer Chidi K. Okim, is familiar with at least this kind of question. She writes, "Many people, especially black people, characterize black conservatives as, quote, Uncle Toms if they don't toe the party line. How does that rhetoric matter by dismissing someone just because their opinion is different?" Chidi K?
Well, I think it touches on, that question touches on some of the things I mentioned earlier in the interview, in the sense that a lot of black conservatives do engage in cartoonishly anti-black rhetoric. The critique of black conservatives isn't completely false. It's not completely false. But if you're characterizing somebody like me in that way, I think that that's a problem. There are, like I said, there's a difference between solution-oriented black conservatives and fame-oriented black conservatives. And to pretend as if fame-oriented black conservatives don't engage in anti-black rhetoric, don't perform for mainstream white conservative audiences, I think is just ridiculous. So I understand that why the term. I understand why people use that term towards a certain group of black conservatives.
But isn't it also possible, Chidi K, then that that we've become so polarized in our politics, in our discourse, that any African American who describes himself as conservative, it's almost like the audience, whoever's in the room, doesn't wait to hear why they describe themselves as a black conservative. They might be immediately judged in a negative way. That might be unfair. Yes?
Yes, I agree with that. I definitely agree with that. In the sense that I think it's important to listen to alternate voices, to listen to different people and actually hear what somebody has to say before you start throwing names at them. However, I do understand that there are some people in the black conservative movement who've engaged in the kind of rhetoric that leads to people calling all black conservatives these kinds of names. So,
all right, so here's some pushback from a listener. Joe writes to the program and says, "As an Asian American, I'm offended at your guest using the harmful model minority stereotype in making his case. He says that's a racist stance And that's from Joe. But Chidike, let me also, before I let you answer Joe's email, I will say that the writer Andrew Sullivan, writing for New York Magazine, recently invoked a similar argument and received, I think, similar opprobrium from many who said that that's sort of outdated, that it's sort of disproven, that it's often sort of peddled out to malign the black community unfairly. What do you think?
The problem I have when people use Asian Americans is when they do it in order to trash black people. I did not do that. I said that we need to copy certain immigrants who come to America and achieve success. I don't understand how that can be considered a racist comment. I'm not suggesting that every Chinese person who comes to America is automatically successful. I just made a comment about a fact, which is that there are some poor Chinese Americans who come to America, Chinese immigrants who come to America and do well because they have a certain mindset towards the building of wealth as opposed to one that is geared towards government assistance and staying in poverty. I don't understand how somebody can have a problem with what I said.
All right. Well, Joe, I appreciate the email. And certainly you can call the program. We've got a little time left here before the hour's up. If you want to call 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. An email from a listener named Gabe. He says, "Evan, what a powerful, refreshing voice. As an independent, I truly believe both major parties have an agenda of suppression." And so let me ask you a question based on his email, GDK. Gabe says, "What a powerful, refreshing voice." And obviously to him, this is a voice he's not heard in mainstream media. Why is it that voices like yours and intellectuals like you have a harder time ending up in the more sort of prominently placed, the cable news shows, the bookings, whereas the Jason Rileys and many others don't have such a hard time? What is going to change that, and why is that currently the climate, do you think, Chidike?
Well, I must say, people like me are a lot less self-promotional, in the sense that the only place I promote my work is on Twitter. I often reject radio interviews. I don't do them very often. So I think maybe it is to do with the fact that some people like me are not all that visible and do not necessarily want to be all that visible. So I have to put that out there. But I also do think it's about incentives as well. Somebody like who says the things that I do is not necessarily going to appeal to mainstream white conservatives. And I don't want to appeal to them. So that's why I'm not on Fox News. If I'm not appealing to their old white demographic, they're not going to have me on, and I understand that. And I don't necessarily, that's not a goal of mine. I want to write for the rest of my life. I want writing opportunities. I don't necessarily care about speaking as much, but I think I have some ideas that I want to put on paper and have people read. As long as I can be read, that is fine. And I don't even care about having a million readers either. I just want to be read by a small group of open-minded, independent people who want to hear something fresh. And that's probably why I don't end up in all of these.
Yeah, fair enough. Gabe, thank you for that. An email from a listener named Henry. He says, "Evan, just wanted to bring up the subject of what we call affirmative action. As a conservative myself, I've always struggled with this, and I'd love to hear what your guest, as a thoughtful black conservative, has to say about affirmative action." That's from Henry. Chidike?
That's interesting. I've actually written some pieces on affirmative action. Previously, I used to be of the opinion that affirmative action is so wrong until I read When Affirmative Action Was What Was White by the Columbia historian Ira Katz Nelson. It's a fantastic book. I also read some books that talk about how legacy students are given preferential treatment in college admissions. So the framing of affirmative action as this thing that helps black people and black people unfairly, I think is actually quite nonsensical when you actually do the research. White women are usually the most prominent beneficiaries of affirmative action. So I think the framing of affirmative action, the whole debate, I think is very tendentious. And I think there needs to be a little bit more nuance to that whole debate.
All right, but in our final minutes here, I want to talk about an issue that has come up a lot in our community here in Western New York, Chidike, which is which is sort of how we have become really, really polarized in where we live. And here's a statistic I've cited a few times, but I think it's worth hammering. In this country in 1976, Jimmy Carter wins election, and 27% of American counties were landslide counties. That's counties where the presidential winner in that county won by 20 points or more. So 27% in 1976. When George W. Bush won re-election in 2004, it was 48% landslide counties. And last year, Donald Trump wins, and 60% of American counties were landslide counties. I mean, that's just one way to illustrate that we're not really living among people who differ all that ideologically from us. And often, that translates, not always, but often, socioeconomically, down racial lines, etc. Well, in our county and in our, you know, sort of region in Western New York, we have a lot of what I would call self-segregation. And as a conservative, you know, I know you believe very strongly in personal liberty. I don't presume that you would ever want to tell someone where they have to live. But I also am curious to know if you're concerned about how we are sort of self-segregating, sometimes down racial lines, and if you see it as a problem.
I haven't really thought about that. But it's possible I might write about that in the future once I've done a lot of thinking about it. So I don't necessarily have an answer for that right now. So
okay.
I'll probably write about it in the future. And I don't like having a extemporaneous interview be the first time I actually discuss something that I haven't necessarily written about.
Okay, so. No problem. And then going forward here, when it comes to the conservative movement, I'll get back to your phone calls in just a second. When it comes to the conservative movement now, you know, you said today you're not sure that black conservatism will ever end up sort of in the same tent as modern American mainstream conservatism. And some of our listeners, I think, don't find that optimistic enough, that there is a hope that that kind of progress can be made, that that kind of self-reflection in the conservative movement can happen. I'm hearing a little pushback from people who are concerned that you're not being optimistic enough about that. So why don't you address some of our listeners who feel that, you know, with some self-reflection in the conservative movement, that there might be a natural fit among African-Americans who are conservative and the mainstream movement.
I disagree with that perspective completely. I don't understand why optimism has to be characterized by proximity to whiteness. I don't understand why that would make me optimistic. I believe that black conservatism should be an independent entity, because we've seen what mainstream conservatism does to black conservatives. So why should I don't understand why that's a critique.
Okay. One of our listeners wants to know what writers you are also reading, and are there other strong black conservative voices?
So I like, obviously, Dr. Sowell, as I said in my piece that on the Intercollegiate Review. I think his books are fantastic. I read them, reread them. I think they're wonderful. I also like Dr. Carter G. Woodson. He's one of my influences. I think The Miseducation of the Negro is one of the best books of all time for me personally. And I think it should be read by every black conservative, because it really does give you the framework of how to be a free market advocate and pro-black at the same time. And I also read Chinua Achebe, the father of African literature, as I said in the piece. I like his nonfiction work. And obviously, as a Igbo writer, it's something that obviously resonates with me. But as for modern black conservatives, I don't necessarily read a lot of them. I tend to read like older authors and older books, and that's where I draw my inspiration.
And listeners, Dr. Sowell, you mentioned Thomas Sowell, S-O-W-E-L-L, is who our guest mentioned in the first example there. I'll take a phone call, and Joe in Rochester, who emailed, wanted to follow up. Go ahead, Joe.
I emailed not because of anything having to do with what the guest is saying in terms of what he's trying to do about the black community. I just took offense at the use of the harmful stereotype of Asians as the model minority, and that people should mimic that, because I've experienced so many times the dark side of that, where there are expectations, and if they're not met, it becomes harmful for foreigners like Asians who are already viewed as different. And having that argument made is just offensive. It's harmful. It does nothing to support your cause, because it's wrong. And I just wanted to make that clear.
All right, GDK, go ahead.
Telling me that something is offensive does not mean that it is wrong. That doesn't demonstrate that it is wrong. What I said is manifestly true. The fact of the matter is there are some people, and if
it
you don't want to use Asian Americans or Chinese Americans or whatever, that's fine.
Proven.
I can use Nigerian
Americans. Joe, hold on.
To make my point.
We'll come back to Joe in a second. Go ahead.
I can use my own people to make my point. Some Nigerian Americans, as demonstrated in the book, The Triple Package, by Amy Schumer and Jed Rubenfeld, come to America with almost nothing and outdo the native population, both educationally and economically. If you don't want to use Asian Americans, that is fine. I will talk about Nigerian Americans. And why do we do that? It is because of a certain mindset that we have towards the creation and the building of wealth as opposed to reliance on government. And that's the point I'm trying to make. It is important for people to have a wealth mindset in order to escape poverty. That is the only way to build wealth. If your mindset is if you look towards the government as your source, if you look towards the government as your future, you are going to be stunted. The government then becomes your ceiling. However, if you have a mindset that is geared towards wealth building and the acquiring of education, you are going to create wealth. That's the point I'm trying to make. All this concern about telling me that I'm wrong and offensive or whatever, offensive doesn't mean wrong. So you disagree? Say you don't like it, but that doesn't mean that I'm wrong.
All right, go ahead, Joe.
That's a false argument. I'm not saying whether, like, the main point, well, it is wrong, but the main point isn't even that if it's wrong or not, it's that he's using the stereotype to make a point. And as if you want to use Nigerian, go ahead. I mean, I don't know. They can complain about whether that's right or not if they want to. I have no right to speak about that. But I do have a right as an Asian American to say that I am offended by that statement and that that stereotype has affected me in detrimental ways. And you do not get to dictate what I get, what I take offense to.
All right, Joe, thank you.
I'm not dictating what you take offense to, sir. What I am telling you is that offense is not an argument. I'm telling you that you need to provide an argument. So telling me you're offended doesn't refute my point. It's the point I'm trying to make.
All right, a couple more minutes here. Tell our listeners a little bit more about your thoughts on, you mentioned a writer who does get a lot of time on NPR, on national talk shows, sells a lot of books, Ta-Nehisi Coates. And it seemed you were critical of his work. Why is that, Chidike?
Because of the Afro-pessimistic worldview that seems to be the major part of his work, I think. So, I don't agree with Afro-pessimism. I don't agree with negativity and thinking that white supremacy is this omnipotent, omniscient force that stops black people from progressing in America. I believe that black people have the ability to survive with or without the actualization of perfect racial harmony. So I don't agree with his writings in that sense. I think he's a wonderful writer. I think he writes very well, but his message, I think, is flawed. And I think a message that encourages people to actually pursue wealth, to pursue education, to thrive, to work hard, I think is the kind of thing that actually moves black people forward. And that has been the reason why black people have progressed in America so far.
Michael on Twitter says, I find the notion that there is only one solution, the nuclear family, and that policies to level the field for people are bad, but money to business is good. I find that offensive. He said, I find the myth of the rugged individualism, stupid in the extreme, pushed by the right as a counterargument to communism. What do you say to that, Chidike?
So is he trying to say that communism is a viable solution? Is that the message he's trying to promote?
I think
that's self-evidently nonsensical.
Okay, and he's also critical of the idea that there's only one solution, and that's the nuclear family. What do you think?
Well, I think the nuclear family has been the thing that has actually created civilization, or has been the foundation of civilization. I don't see why you need to reinvent the wheel. I don't understand his argument, basically.
My guest for the hour has been Chidike Okeem, and that's O-K-E-E-M. You can find his website, Voice of Chid, C-H-I-D, voiceofchid.com, also Voice of Chid on Twitter. I'll close with this here. Are you working on any other sort of big projects or ideas that you're writing about that are on your radar right now, Chidike?
No, not at the moment, but I'm always cooking essays in my brain, so an essay can drop at any time, so I would just say stay tuned.
Well, it's great to have you, and I know our listeners appreciate it. It's a perspective that doesn't often get heard, a black conservatism that is very different than modern American conservatism, but certainly not in league with black progressivism. So thank you for taking the time, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me, Evan. It was a pleasure.
You got it. Chidike Okeem, our guest for the hour on Connections. And let's get a short break. Next hour, we're talking to one of the candidates for Rochester Mayor in studio as we continue that series. That's next on Connections.